On the night of July 17, 1996, a Boeing 747 headed to Paris experienced a sudden change of plans as it suddenly plummeted to the ground, killing all 230 souls on board. It would take years for an analysis to reveal a suspected cause of crash, a cause that to this day remains in question. Today, TWA Flight 800 on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
TWA Flight 800, Part 2. In February 1998, the FBI, having closed its active investigation, agreed to fully release the witness summaries to the NTSB. 10, with access to these documents no longer controlled by the FBI, the NTSB formed a second witness group to review the documents. Because of the amount of time that had elapsed, about 21 months before the NTSB received information about the identity of the witnesses, the witness group chose not to re-interview the witnesses, but instead to rely on the original summaries of witnesses' statements written by the FBI agents as the best available evidence of the observations initially reported by the witnesses. Despite the 2.5 years that had elapsed since the accident, the witness group did interview the captain of Eastwind Airlines Flight 507, who was the first to report the explosion of TWA 800, because of his vantage point and experience as an airline pilot. The NTSB's review of the released witness documents determined that they contained 736 witness accounts, of which 258 were characterized as streak-of-light witnesses, an object moving in the sky, ferociously described as a point of light, fireworks, a flare, or a shooting star, or something similar. The NTSB witness group concluded that the streak of light reported by witnesses might have been an actual airplane during some stage of its flight before the fireball developed, noting that most of the 258 streaks of light accounts were generally consistent with the calculated flight path of the accident airplane after the CWT explosion. 38 witnesses described a streak of light that ascended vertically, or nearly so. These accounts seem to be inconsistent with the accident airplane's flight path. In addition, 18 witnesses reported seeing a streak of light that originated on the surface or the horizon, which did not appear to be consistent with the airplane's calculated flight path or other known aspects of the accident sequence. Regarding these differing accounts, the NTSB noted that based on their experience in previous investigations, witness reports are often inconsistent with the known facts or with other witness reports of the same events. The interviews conducted by the FBI focused on the possibility of a missile attack, suggested interview questions given to FBI agents such as where was the sun in relation to the aircraft and the missile launch point? How long did the missile fly? Could the biased interviewees' responses in some cases? The NTSB concluded that given the large number of witnesses in this case, they did not expect all of the documented witness observations to be consistent with one another, and did not view these, apparently, witness reports as presumptive evidence that some witnesses might have observed a missile. After missile visibility tests were conducted in April of 2000 at Elgin Air Force Base, Fort Walton Beach, Florida, the NTSB determined that if witnesses had observed a missile attack, they would have seen a light from the burning missile motor ascending very rapidly and steeply for about 8 seconds, the light disappearing for up to 7 seconds upon the missile striking the aircraft and igniting the CWT. Another light moving considerably more slowly and more laterally than the first for about 30 seconds, this light descending while simultaneously developing into a fireball falling towards the ocean. None of the witness documents describe such a scenario. Because of their unique vantage points or the level of precision and detail provided in their accounts, 5 witness accounts generally special interest. The pilot of Eastwind Airlines Flight 507, the crew members of the HH-60 helicopter, and streak of light witness aboard U.S. Airways Flight 217, a land witness on the Beach Lane Bridge in West Hampton Beach, New York, and a witness on a boat near Great Gun Beach. Advocates of a missile attack scenario asserted that some of these witnesses observed a missile. Analysis demonstrated that the observations were not consistent with a missile attack on TWA 800, but instead were consistent with these witnesses having observed part of an in-flight fire and breakup sequence after the explosion. The NTSB concluded that the witness observations of a streak of light were not related to a missile, and that the streak of light reported by most of these witnesses was burning fuel from the accident airplane in crippling flight during some portion of the post-explosion pre-impact breakup sequence. The NTSB further concluded that the witnesses' observations of one or more fireballs were of the airplane's burning wreckage falling towards the ocean. Possible ignition sources of the center wing fuel tank to determine what ignited the flammable fuel air vapor in the CWT and caused the explosion. The NTSB evaluated numerous potential ignition sources. All but one were considered very unlikely to have been the source of ignition. Missile fragment or small explosive charge. Although the NTSB had already reached the conclusion that a missile strike did not cause the structural failure of the airplane, the possibility that a missile could have exploded close enough to TWA 800 for a missile fragment to have entered the CWT and ignited the fuel air vapor, yet far enough away not to have left any damage characteristics of a missile strike, was considered. Computer simulations using missile performance data simulated a missile detonating in a location such that a fragment from the warhead could penetrate the CWT. Based on these simulations, the NTSB concluded that it was very unlikely that a warhead detonated in such a location where a fragment could penetrate the CWT, but no other fragments impact the surrounding airplane structure, leaving distinctive impact marks. So as we continue into the story of TWA Flight 800 in our part two on the dark side of Wikipedia, please press subscribe, whatever platform you're listening to our program on. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Greatly appreciate that. It's Tony and Sean again on today's episode. What do you make of this, where you have, literally 700 some people interviewed that did see the plane go down? You got to figure a lot of them not really looking to the sky until they hear the sound wave reach them of the explosion, or they see the flash in the sky and the plane's already going down. That accounts for 400 some. The other 270 some were just in the area watching the sky, seeing an airplane, and then catching this flame of some sort going towards the plane. But that being said, is no, you just saw the plane blowing up. Thoughts?
Well, I'd like to think that, short of being a psychic, you're not looking up in the sky searching for a missile that is en route to an airplane. So as we read more and dive into this, just by human nature, if you really think to yourself, what causes you to look somewhere? Mm-hmm. What causes you to see a car accident or something that is usually the actual accident, the point of impact, when it happens? So your brain is not recording, it's not making a memory of what you saw or remembering when you're then being a witness until after that initial whatever it is happened. So I think as we learn more about this, and even in a situation where they did a recreation of events where even if a missile were to explode close enough, mm-hmm, to cause the explosion, but not to leave any residue or any marks, that they really did dive deep. And initially, where we thought they didn't take those witnesses into account and they just thought, well, no, we're just going to try to come up with something else. They did a lot more. And I think that is, at least for me, I can understand that, again, short of being a psychic, short of just stargazing into the entire sky and looking up for long periods of time and then realizing, whoa, what is that? People didn't look until after that initial impact happened. So therefore, it makes sense to me that is burning wreckage. It's not a missile. It already happened. And now you're just seeing all of the remnants falling into the ocean.
You're making a lot of sense, and I, for the longest time, and I still think there's a good part of me, and I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but I think there's some things where things have been covered up. I don't know a logical reason why this would be covered up as a missile, other than maybe it was accidentally fired or there was some sort of war exercise that was going on that it was a mistake. It was clearly not intended to hit a passenger airliner, and whoever did it is connected with the government, and they certainly don't want the responsibility of that. That could be a conspiracy theory or a possibility. But what I also think about that does support the government's assertion and the NTSB's assertion that there was no missile attack and what these people saw was part of the plane blowing up. The example I would make is if you've ever been around a bunch of fireworks on the 4th of July, and you got, you know, your crazy Uncle Dick that's out there just shooting shit off left and right.
Hey, I bought these off the interstate. Well, what does it do? Fuck, I don't know, but it was 1999, so let's shoot it off right next to our garage.
I'm going to light it, and I'm going to throw it behind Grandma over there who's 74. She's going to get a good scare out of that. Literally, kind of some of my... Except it was with a northern accent. I don't know why I always go to southern accent. It was more like,
hey, so we got some fireworks off the interstate there in Kenosha.
Yeah. Let's. I got some M80s. Them are almost kind of like dynamite, you know? Oh, you like that hot dog? Boom! Oh, that scared you, didn't you?
Hey, see that open field where there's nothing flammable around it? Let's go shoot them off there. No, no, no. Let's go over to Aunt Helen's house. She's got a pacemaker and has a really, really small backyard with a lot of kindling. Let's light them off there, next to her. If she gets scared, she may die. Let's do it.
All the kids are around. I know there's like about 8 or 9, 5 to 10-year-olds running around here crazily. Let's just chuck these around and see if they go off. Let's see what happens.
Well, hell, they got the lawn darts there. They're basically, you know, daggers, and they throw them up in the air. So how about we put some kielbasa on the grill, and then we see if we can all die. It's like a mass grave. Suicides for all.
I brought the flavor aid. So, yeah. So here's my point. When you shoot off, for example, sometimes like a bottle rocket or something into the sky, it'll not always, you'll have one that's what you'd call like a dud. It goes up. It doesn't just go straight up and burst. Sometimes it goes up and then boom, it's like part of it like shoots around in a circle in the sky because part of it broke off. And could that be what we're talking about here? What we're seeing was part of that engine or part of the plane or something that had propelled itself off the plane with some sort of fuel from the plane, went down a little bit, and then the fuel, it kind of turned itself around in the air and then shot itself up back towards the plane. I've seen fireworks do it. I suppose any sort of item that has a fuel source behind it and it is moving at an accelerated speed could spin around in the air and then make it appear for that split second, for those whatever how many seconds they saw something, did this thing break off of the plane, and then in air it turned itself around simply by wind and gravity and propulsion of the fuel source, and then start going back towards the plane, not necessarily causing the plane to blow up, but certainly looking as if something is flying towards the plane, because in fact something was flying towards the plane, but not a missile, but part of the plane that had a fuel ignition source behind it that was kind of just deteriorating in the air and going whichever way gravity and wind and direction shall take it. I guess that could certainly be another possibility here, and maybe what happened with TWA Flight 800.
You're dealing with a 747, and even if you're not an airplane enthusiast, that's a big-ass plane. If you Google image 747, so the fuel, the wind, there are so many variables to keep such a large piece of machinery all going in the same direction. You have any part of that go off it? Who knows what direction it's going to go? And with the engines and the winds and the fuel, so I would like to think that it would have been darn near impossible, whatever explosion happened, for all components of the plane to go the same direction at the same speed and to not go different angles and such. So I don't think that's far-fetched whatsoever, that something came loose from the plane and then appeared to almost look as though that it's going back to the plane. Half the plane with the whole front of it falling off, elevated thousands of feet. It's like a person without their head flying upwards and outwards, and then eventually came down. So that's a lot of shit going on that who knows what direction it will go in.
And then you're trying to process this all in the course of like 10 seconds as you're witnessing something that most people never see in their lifetime, other than maybe on a video if it's out there. And that's it. So you're trying to make sense of all this. And logically, yes, the first thing that would come to your mind if you're witnessing that would be to say, well, there was something flying at the plane, missile. That's what our mind would tell us to think. And again, I'm not completely discounting the possibility of a missile. I'm just trying to look at all aspects of, well, what could this be logically if it's not a missile? Because I do believe these people saw something fly towards the plane. But what was it that flew towards the plane? And I think that could also be just as easily a logical explanation, considering when we look at the wreckage of the plane and when they reconstructed that thing in that hangar, there, as far as I'm aware, there really, I mean, to the naked eye, to me, not being a crash investigator, seeing the pictures of this thing, there did not appear to be a giant hole in the side of the plane as if a missile hit it. It seemed much more intact. I mean, broken apart, certainly, but and I believe the investigators also stated there really wasn't evidence of a missile impact to the plane. So that's, you know, obviously you kind of want to go with the experts. America has never been a country that's necessarily shied away from trying to get into a war with somebody trying to do it wrong. But they have certainly shied away from their own faults of things when guilty. And trying to rewrite history or never write history, which would make it at fault in many, many cases. So it's a big hodgepodge of this or that and previous experience. I mean, there's the level of this with this story of abuse and the abuser. With the government having abused power many times, made up shit that we found out to be not true, and then expecting the general public to just completely put their faith into it and say, yes, whatever you say must be right. You're going to have many that say, well, you've done me wrong one too many times. I don't know that I'm going to take you at your word, considering a couple hundred people over here say they saw something different. But it's not always the case that there is something nefarious at hand. Let's continue on here with TWA Flight 800 Part 2 on the dark side of Wikipedia. Similarly, the investigation considered the possibility that a small explosive charge placed on the plane could have been the ignition source. Testing by the NTSB and the British Defense Evaluation and Research Agency demonstrated that when metal of the same type and thickness was penetrated by small charge, there was patelling of the surface where the charge was placed, pitting on the adjacent surfaces, and visible hot gas washing damage in the surrounding area. Since none of the recorded CWT wreckage exhibited this damage characteristics, and none of the area of missing wreckage were large enough to encompass all the expected damage, the investigation concluded that this scenario was very unlikely. Other potential sources, the NTSB also investigated whether the fuel-air mixture in the CWT could have ignited by lightning strike, meteor strike, auto-ignition, or hot surface ignition, a fire migration to the CWT from another fuel tank via the vent system, an uncontrolled or uncontained engine failure, a turbine burst in the air conditioning packs beneath the CWT, a malfunctioning CWT jettison override pump, a malfunctioning CWT scavenger pump, or static electricity. After analysis, the investigation determined that these potential sources were also very unlikely to have been the source of ignition. Because of a combustible fuel-air mixture will always exist in fuel tanks, Boeing designers had attempted to eliminate all possible sources of ignition in the 747's tanks. To do so, all devices are protected from vapor intrusion, and voltages and currents used by the fuel quality indication system are kept very low. In the case of the 747-100 series, the only wiring located in the CWT is that which is associated with the FQIS. In order for the FQIS to have been Flight 800's ignition source, a transfer of higher than normal voltage to the FQIS would have needed to occur, as well as some mechanism whereby the excess energy was released by the FQIS wiring into the CWT. While the NTSB determined that factors suggesting the likelihood of a short circuit event existed, they added that neither the release mechanism nor the location of the ignition inside the CWT could be determined from the available evidence. Nonetheless, the NTSB concluded that the ignition energy for the CWT explosion most likely entered the CWT through the FQIS wiring. Though the FQIS itself was designed to prevent danger by minimizing voltages and currents, the innermost tube of Flight 800's FQIS compensator showed damage similar to that of the compensator tube identified as the ignition source for that surge tank fire that destroyed a 747 near Madrid in 1976. This was not considered proof of a source of ignition. Evidence of arching was found in a wire bundle that included FQIS wiring connected to the center wing tank. Arching signs were also seen on two wires sharing a cable raceway with FQIS wiring at station 955. The captain's cockpit voice recorder channel showed two dropouts of background power harmonics in the second before the recorded ending. This might well be the signature of an arc on cockpit wiring adjacent to the FQIS wiring. The captain commented on the crazy readings of the number 4 engine fuel flow gauge about 2.5 minutes before the CVR recording ended. Finally, the central wing tank fuel quantity gauge was recovered and indicated 640 pounds instead of the 300 pounds that had been loaded into that tank. Experiments showed that applying power to a wire leading to the fuel quantity gauge can cause the digital display to change by several hundred pounds before the circuit breaker trips. Thus, the gauge abnormality could have been caused by a short to the FQIS wiring. The NTSB concluded that the most likely source of sufficient voltage to cause ignition was a short from damaged wiring or within electrical components of the FQIS, as not all components and wiring were recovered. It's not possible to pinpoint the source of the necessary voltage. So they end up kind of leaning in that direction, it seems. And we'll go to the report conclusions in our next chapter of the story. To me, it's amazing just in general. If you've ever been on an airplane that had a shitload of turbulence, that I guess more planes don't go down randomly. Just thinking of how violent turbulence can be and all of these components that are screwed together, welded together, affixed somehow together. And when you're sitting there shaking the thing like a child violently shaking a toy at Christmas, that more shit doesn't get loose and arc and go wrong in the sky. I think it's more of a testament to the engineering and the safety that we have on the mass amount of planes that are in the sky, that more stuff doesn't go wrong with them, with the abuse that some of these planes take in the sky, that every once in a while, well, something that really shouldn't be arcing or shouldn't go wrong does happen to go wrong. Because between every single flight, they're not sitting there examining every single component of the plane. It would be physically impossible to do, to take all the wall paneling off and look at everything and check everything and test everything. They're relying on their gauges and their meters to be accurate. And when that's not accurate, you're not going to know it's not accurate quite often until it's too late.
There's a reason that there's a door in the cockpit of an airplane, and it's not anything to do with September 11th. If you're listening to this show and you think to yourself, oh, doors were always locked. Absolutely. Pilots would never get up mid-flight and go and use the restroom. No, there was. And there was sometimes where they would even like let some passengers look in the cockpit if airplane dorks like myself. But I think the main reason that there's a door between the cabin and the cockpit is I think half the plane would have a heart attack. Any turbulence and any sensor and any shit that the pilot has to deal with, airplanes are such magical machines that can withstand so much weather and such that every now and again, people are so scared of flying and they don't want to fly because they're going to die in this side or the other. Not even close to the amount of harm you can be in driving across the country than you are flying. And to your point, there is so much that an airplane has that being on the ground for 45 minutes to turn around a flight, you just can't do it. I mean, you just can't do it. There are mechanical, meticulous safety checks that engineers do with all airplanes, but sometimes, sadly, things just happen where pilots' eyes can't be in 13 places at once and something occurs.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been little Jimmy? Little Jimmy, come on up here to the cockpit and sit on my lap while we fly the plane.
You know, I've sat on a pilot's lap. It wasn't in an airplane. It was actually in a dark alley, and I don't want to talk about it, Tony. So thank you. But I did get my first pair of wings that night.
God.
I never did, and I that was 100% a joke, by the way. Yeah. Just a tough crowd. No, not all people are going to get it. But there was an airline that originated in our home state, Wisconsin, Midwest Express Airlines, and they were kind of like the Cadillac of the airline industry. They had leather seats. They had phenomenal dinners. They had a kid on a flight that I went to down to Florida, because that's what you do if you're from the north. You go to warm places in the summer for summer vacations. There was a kid on the plane. It wasn't me. It was a different little Jimmy who got to go up in the cockpit and see the cockpit and the pilots and sit in the seat where the captain flies the plane. And I was back in 22D crying, looking at that little kid, wishing it was me.
Have you ever gotten over it? Or did that lead you to the dark alleys searching for a pilot behind the Walgreens?
Pandemics, you got to make dollar bills, all right? You got to make that money.
So there you are behind the Osco drug. Are there any pilots back here?
I just want to fly my nonstop to Cleveland with the window seat.
I want to earn my wings. God, yeah. Well, there you go. That I'm glad that we know what you've been up to during the pandemic. I can relate. It wasn't on an airplane, though. It was on a boat. It was I think it might have been one of the boats that go over to Mackinac Island. And I remember being a kid. They were sitting there, and then the captain of the boat goes, "Little Timmy," and the kid's name was like literally Little Timmy or something. And why don't you come over here and drive the boat? And it was a kid that was like near me, but not me. And he got to drive the boat for a few minutes. And I was sitting there going, "I wish I was Little Timmy." And then my dad says, "I bet you wish you were Little Timmy." Like, thanks, Dad. Yes, I do. I do. I do wish I was little Timmy.
Did you ever, and this could happen earlier in life, this could happen last week, where you're anticipating, you're excited for something, and someone calls on what you think is you, like, "Oh, Tony," or "Oh, you, sir," but it's not you. So you stand up and you're excited, and then you quickly realize, "Oh, shit, he was talking about two people behind me," or he was talking about the other little Timmy.
Yeah.
And then you kind of got to play it off as, "Oh, I was just stretching my... I was just stretching my legs. I'm going to sit right back down here."
He's like, "Hi, I don't know who you are, but hi." Oh, you're talking to the person behind me.
Oh,
yeah.
Baby.
I've done that a time or two. Yeah. Let's continue on here with the NTSB investigation and the report conclusions for TWA Flight 800. The NTSB investigation ended with the adoption of the board's final report on August 23rd. 2000. The board determined that the probable cause of TWA 800 accident was an explosion of the center wing fuel tank, resulting from the ignition of the flammable fuel air mixture in the tank. The source of ignition energy from the explosion could not be determined with certainty, but of the sources evaluated by the investigation, the most likely was a short circuit outside of the CWT that allowed excessive voltage to enter it through electrical wiring associated with the fuel quantity indication system. In addition to the probable cause, the NTSB found the following contributing factors to be part of the accident. The design and certification concept that fuel tank explosions could be prevented solely by precluding all ignition sources. The certification of the Boeing 747 with heat sources located beneath the CWT with no means to reduce the heat transferred into the CWT or to render the fuel tank vapor non-combustible. During the course of its investigation and in its final report, the NTSB issued 15 safety recommendations, mostly covering fuel tank and wiring-related issues. Among the recommendations was that significant consideration should be given to the development of modifications such as nitrogen inertial systems for new airplanes, designed and, where feasible, for existing airplanes. The NTSB's conclusion about the cause of TWA Flight 800's disaster took 4 years and 1 month to be published. The FBI's earliest investigation and interviews later used by the NTSB were performed under the assumption of a missile attack, a fact reported in the NTSB's final report. 6 months into the investigation, the NTSB's chairman, Jim Hall, was quoted as saying, "All three theories, a bomb, a missile attack, or mechanical failure, remain." Speculation was fueled in part by early descriptions, visuals, and eyewitness accounts of the disaster that indicated a sudden explosion and trails of fire moving in an upward direction. On June 19, 2013, the NTSB acknowledged in a press release that they received a petition for reconsideration of its investigation into the July 17, 1996 crash of TWA Flight 800. In 2014, the NTSB declined the petition to reopen the investigation. In a press release, the NTSB stated, "After a thorough review of all information provided by petitioners, the NTSB denied the petition in its entirety because the evidence and analysis presented did not show the original findings were incorrect." Many internet users responded to the incident. The resulting web traffic set records for internet activity at the time. CNN's traffic quadrupled to 3.9 million hits per day. After the tragedy, the website of the New York Times saw its traffic increase to 1.5 million hits per day, 50% higher than its previous rate. In 1996, few U.S. government websites were updated daily, but the United States Navy crash website was consistently updated and had detailed information about the salvage of the crash site. The wreckage is permanently stored in an NTSB facility in Ashburn, Virginia, that was custom-built for the purpose. The reconstructed aircraft is used to train accident investigators. On July 18, 2008, the Secretary of Transportation visited the facility and announced a final rule designed to prevent accidents caused by fuel tank explosions. The rule required airlines to pump inert gas into the tanks. The rule covered all center wing tanks on all new passenger and cargo airliners and passenger planes built in most of the 1990s, but not old cargo planes. The NTSB at first recommended such a rule just 5 months earlier the incident and 33 years after a similar recommendation issued by the Civil Aeronautics Board Bureau of Safety on December 17, 1963, 9 days after the crash of Pan Am Flight 214. The crash of TWA Flight 800 and that of ValuJet Flight 592 earlier in 1996 prompted Congress to pass the Aviation Disaster Family Assistance Act of 1996 as part of the Federal Aviation Appropriations Bill. Among other things, the act gives NTSB, instead of the particular airline involved, responsibility for coordinating services to families of victims of fatal aircraft accidents in the United States. In addition, it restricts lawyers and other parties from contacting family members within 30 days of the accident. During the investigation, the NTSB and the FBI clashed with each other. The agencies lacked a detailed protocol describing which agency should take the lead, and when it was initially unclear if an event was an accident or a criminal act. At the time of the crash, 49 CFR 831-5 specify that the NTSB's aviation accident investigations have priority over all other federal investigations. After the TWA Flight 800 investigation, the NTSB recognized the need for better clarity. The NTSB sought and secured language to clarify the issue in 49 U.S.C. 1131A2B, which was amended in 2000 to read, "If the Attorney General, in consultation with the Chairman of the NTSB, determines and notifies the NTSB that circumstances reasonably indicate that the accident may have been caused by an intentional criminal act, the NTSB shall relinquish investigative priority to the FBI." The relinquishment of investigation priority by the NTSB shall not otherwise affect the authority of the NTSB to continue its investigation under this section. In 2005, the NTSB and the FBI entered into a memorandum of understanding that states that in the immediate aftermath of a transportation accident, the NTSB is the presumptive lead investigative agency and will assume control of the accident scene. The FBI may still conduct a criminal investigation, but the NTSB investigation has priority. When investigative priority remains with the NTSB, the FBI must coordinate its investigative activities with the NTSB investigator in charge. This authority includes interviewing witnesses. The MOU states that this procedure is intended to ensure that neither NTSB or FBI investigative activity unnecessarily complicates or compromises the other agency's investigation. The new statutory language and the MOU have improved coordination between the NTSB and FBI since the TWA Flight 800 accident. As of 2005, NTSB and FBI personnel conduct joint exercises. Each agency can call upon the other laboratories and other assets. The NTSB and FBI have designated liaisons to ensure that information flows between agencies and to coordinate on-scene operations. Heidi Snow, the fiancée of Flight 800 victim Michael Bernstoff, established the Aircraft Casualty Emotional Support Services nonprofit group together with families of victims of Pan Am Flight 103. So, I'm all about things working more smoothly. There seems to be a lot of the word suggestions or recommendations that are used quite freely within government agencies to private companies because these planes were privately owned by these private companies. They're not government owned vehicles or anything like that, or designed by the government. Of course, the government needs to approve of their designs, and these designs were approved before they ever took flight. But I think far too often we hear the word, we recommend, we suggest, rather than you better fucking do it or we're not going to let you ever fly again. Maybe that's a little harsh, but maybe it should be more along the lines of are required to follow these, not recommendations, these requirements issued by the NTSB. We've seen a lot of it. The most current example, and I'm not going to go down the road of COVID right now, but there's been a shitload of we recommend, this state recommends, this city recommends, this county recommends, this country recommends. Joe down the road, who hasn't left his home in 5 years and wears tin foil and collects cat corpses, recommends. And sometimes Joe with the tin foil, as long as he has enough followers, will get more credence to his recommendations than a legitimate agency. I think the legitimate agency should be more so in the world of not recommending, but requiring. When they find something could go horribly wrong if the recommendations are not followed. Because business, they're not people. There's people that work for them, but the business is a business. It doesn't have feelings. It doesn't necessarily have the, you know, relationship with other human beings. It doesn't necessarily have the desire. It doesn't necessarily, the people behind it don't want to kill people. But at the end of the day, it's there to make money. And it's going to, more times than not, follow the path that's going to be most cost effective versus risk adverse. And if they find that the cost of life, and I'm not saying this of TWA or anything specifically, but if we just look into history, this is how it ends up working. If the cost and the damage that is done, if one in every 1 million flights crashes versus retrofitting things on a recommendation that is not required, many businesses will take the route of, well, every 1 million planes may crash and it will still be cheaper for us in the long run versus retrofitting every single plane. So we're going to go down that route of what's going to be cheaper. And that can be said of maybe this. It can be said of many other industries as well. And that's where there needs to be more than just a recommendation put out there when things are found to have or to be at fault. Thoughts?
Tony, how do you feel about recommendations? I really was a little confused. Could you
elaborate? It leads to mass fucking chaos. Because that's what we're seeing right now. It leads to everybody going, well, I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to do what so-and-so recommends. And they are doing what so-and-so recommends. But it just so happens that there's also 30 other completely adverse recommendations with that first recommendation that the other people are following. And you need a clear picture in a time of crisis that says, here's how we're doing shit. And here's what really should be done, you know, for the safety. And you're always going to have somebody, no matter how clear and how safe the idea is, there will always be some people that will give you backlash and say, I want to do it this way. But you cannot not enforce things because you don't want to hurt the feelings or offend some people, or some people are going to not want to do something some way, when for the mass good, we should be doing it this way. Even if it costs a shitload of money, and if a company goes under in some cases because they can't afford to do some things, sorry, I guess it's better than a bunch of people dying on an aircraft or whatever the case may be. We need to do things in a more cohesive way. It's not just America. I mean, it's society as a whole. And I don't know that we're ever going to do this, but it's just, it's how people work. It's more of an observation of how people work than anything else.
Yeah, and I think a situation like this that seems so simple, which clearly is not, that will not ever be completely satisfied for the greater good. Yeah. Sadly, money will outweigh a person's life. You pick the scenario. Too many things have happened to show that is anything but 100% true. But within this situation of the airline industry in this specific situation, from this, and I can't imagine losing a loved one, but it sounds as though there was a lot that has improved in the industry and the verbiage with the NTSB and the FBI so that they could kind of know what the hell to do. It's not so clear as mud anymore in future tragic events. And it seemed to better the industry. And clearly, I don't foresee what happened back in 1997. This wouldn't happen in 2020.
It's gone from,
and it just so that's that's a positive, I guess, I'll take from it in something so tragic.
It's gone from muddy water to Sharkleberry Finn Kool-Aid. So it's a little more translucent. It's improved a bit, but we're still not in that pure, clear Brita water that where things seem to make more sense. And, you know, and I don't know that we ever will be. I don't know that human motive will ever allow us to be, just because everyone's going to have a different opinion on how things should be handled, and rightfully so. And everyone has their own personal interests at stake in a crisis situation. And you got to take a look at everybody's situation and understand where they're coming from. I think maybe that's more what we need to look at than anything else, is a little bit more understanding of everyone else's opinions and situations, as long as they're sane and valid. And I guess you can go into that road of, well, what's sane and valid? But as long as they make sense and you can logically connect the dots as to where someone is coming from, maybe it might be where you're coming from. Maybe it not be your truth. And I hate that term. But there may be somebody else's, and there may be a logical reason why they feel one way or another, and you have to understand and sympathize with it somewhat. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's right, but you have to take into account where someone's coming from and sometimes make some concessions so others can be satisfied or things can work in a more smooth way. And then everyone can be unhappy and nothing can ever be fixed. It's one of those things, but I think TWA Flight 800 is really a case where there's so many possibilities. I don't know that we're ever going to truly 100% know exactly what happened, but I don't think reopening the investigation is going to tell us a whole hell of a lot more than what we already know. We're talking, more than almost 25 years ago of a plane crash, and it's like once history has moved on so much and evidence has moved around so much and eyewitnesses are dead and all that, and it's like, well, here's what we got. it is what it is.
And what's very interesting, and this has nothing to do directly with the flight, but just more in maybe a future show we could talk about this, is do you believe that everything that has happened in a negative way in history, we are in a time in our world, in society, that we want to redo? Oh, fucked up there. Let's redo it here. Oh, that was bad there. Let's redo it there. Here's the thing. I don't disagree with that statement whatsoever. But history, the word, the definition in and of itself, it's history. Like, that happened. All right. So now moving forward, what can we do? Well, history says that's pretty fucking shitty that women couldn't vote. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Kind of fix that. Now they can. Rather than, oh, this one thing happened 12 years ago, and now we are going to totally screw the guilty culprit of, and I'm not saying there was a murder 12 years ago and there was a person who did it was free up until he was caught or she and arrested and now in prison. That's one thing, but more of a cultural, more of a group thing that happened that wasn't the best 10, 15, 20 years ago, to now try to treat them shittier, to kind of try to make up for what they did bad 20 years ago. I just don't see the positive or the productivity in that. We all know what happened. Okay. Mm-hmm. But, and again, this is a very, very broad, vague topic, but I just feel as though rather than being just a good person on a daily basis and not necessarily being a dick, holding the door, smile. I mean, very boring stuff that wouldn't make a sexy status update or a tweet whatsoever. Yeah. It would be a really cool meme with the sunset in the background on the gram. Who, just don't be a dick, all right? Yeah. Don't be a dick. And I have a t-shirt. I'm not wearing it today, but it says don't be a dick. I don't, but I could probably make a lot of money off of it in addition to my Darky Alley side job being the captain. What I'm trying to say, don't be an asshole. Yeah. That's all you need to do. And then do that today, do it tomorrow. God forbid, do it next week. And maybe, just maybe, collectively, when we're having our wind down Wednesday nights with our fellow lady friends, or we're hanging with our buddies when we actually get to go to a sporting event in 2024, that kind of ignites itself and some shit that doesn't necessarily vibe with the greater masses of the clusterfuckery, maybe that doesn't continue. Because we've maybe not been as much of a dick and so narrow-minded that it's got to start somewhere. And yeah. I think that we are trying to break down a wall that's about 200 stories tall and not succeeding because we don't bring it back. And to your point of being more empathetic or understanding what others are going through, bring it back even more. Just don't be a dick.
Like, yeah.
And see where it goes, because we've not been successful in any other ways.
Yeah, it's something where no matter what we're talking about, no matter what you want to look at, you cannot change the past. You can't change what someone else did. You can't change what you did. You can't. Actions have been taken well beyond all of our lifetimes. And I'm not talking about any specific incident or piece of history. I'm just saying in general, you can't change those things, but we can change our future. We can change how we want to live, how we want to treat each other, how we want things to go. And if we can do that, exactly to your point, don't be a dick. Don't lie. Don't hide things. Don't cover up things. Don't just do the right thing. If we could have more of that going on, and less, well, because something happened, horribly egregious, whatever it may be, in some point in history. It's one thing if you're talking about the actual culprit, if they're alive. It's another if you're just talking about somebody who, you know, was related to them seven generations later, or even one generation later, but they never knew the person. That's a different person. That's a different time. They probably, maybe they don't want to be the dick. Maybe they want nothing to do with that other person or that group or something that they, their, the name that they were given without choice was associated with. You know, it's one of those things where if we can collectively just go, look, we're not the past. Let's not be the past. Let's not continue to be the past. Let's define who we want to be going forward, whether that be how we're going to handle an accident scene or how we're going to handle just treating one another. And it all goes down to, you're exactly right. Don't be a dick. So
.com.
.com. Yes. Don't be. I wonder if that's taken. I would imagine it probably is. But that's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia on Flight TWA, Flight 800. Until next time, for all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. Thanks for listening.